Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
We're seeing a criminalization of many different aspects of life here in the United States, and the people who are paying the price of it by becoming inmates in prison or becoming detainees in detention centers are, you know, African American people, Latinos, immigrants, Asian American people, poor people, people of color, women overwhelmingly, and young people, especially young people. So this is criminalizing a whole new generation of people here. You know, and this is kind of the application of this sort of neoliberal model.
That's the voice of author David Bacon. On this week's show, we speak to David Bacon about his book Illegal People and the connection to globalization, forced migration, and inequity, and how the Occupy movement has been addressing some of these questions. So stay tuned.
Someone who has studied the issue of not just marginalization of the many, but also criminalization of people is my next guest, David Bacon. He is an award-winning photographer, photojournalist. He's an author. The author of Illegal People, How Globalization Creates Migration and Criminalizes Immigrants. That's his latest book, and we're very privileged to have him on our program. Thank you again for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Sylvia, and with your listeners also.
Now, when we think about the word illegal people, it already has a kind of connotation that there is a hierarchy of people. There are those who are legal and those who are illegal. Why do you choose to call your book Illegal People?
Well, for exactly the reason that you just said, is that we live in a world of inequality, a world in which some people are treated as people with rights and people who have a legitimate presence in the communities where they live, and other people who are treated as illegitimate people, people who don't have rights, people who don't belong in the places where they're living. And increasingly, that difference is also established by the fact that people are moving from one place to another. In other words, people are migrating. You know, the system of social inequality in North America is very, very old, going back to the original colonization of the continent, the genocide of First Peoples. When I'm teaching a class, I ask people who were the first illegal people in North America. And it's very interesting to hear what people's responses, because often people will say, well, Europeans were, and in a way, you know, there's a lot of logic to that, because in the eyes of people who were already living in North America, the people who were arriving on boats from Europe were interlopers, were intruders. But very quickly, those people became the people with rights, the people with power, and the native people who were living here were treated as people who had no rights, you know, in fact, not only no rights, but people who were subject to extermination. And then we had a whole system of slavery that was established, in which the difference between people and the inequality was written into law, in which the famous drop of African blood, in other words, any degree of African ancestry at all, was enough to make you a slave in the colonies of the U.S. South, or what was it wasn't the U.S. yet, but, you know, those colonies where slavery had been established. So the system of inequality is very old. But today, what the book is really looking at is the way in which people are being uprooted and displaced in communities where people have been living for hundreds, in fact, thousands of years. For instance, the people from Oaxaca who speak Mixteco or Zapoteco or Triqui, the indigenous languages of people of Oaxaca, are now being uprooted and are traveling to the U.S. and increasingly to Canada, where people are working as farm workers. And so the book tries to take a look at what is it that has taken place in the global economy that has uprooted people in these, you know, historically long-established communities. And then why is it that when those people arrive in the U.S. and Canada as migrants, they arrive with no legal status, with not just being treated as second-class citizens, but as people who are not citizens at all. In other words, as interlopers, as though they were somehow illegitimate people whose presence is not recognized, or the legitimacy of whose presence isn't recognized by the society in which they live, even though that same society is very dependent on the labor of these people in order to do things like pick fruits and vegetables or work in meatpacking plants or do work that is not only socially necessary, but work that if people weren't doing it, our societies wouldn't be able to function.
Here's where I think we need to concentrate a little bit, because when we think about our communities today, people tell you, well, we live in a globalized society, you know, the world has shrunk. There's this free movement of people and goods and capital. And it's a very rosy picture. When I think of globalization and of the people that I know personally in my community, I think of people who don't have rights, as you point out. So what are the stories that we're not hearing about this kind of productive society, an efficient process of mobilizing goods in our economy? What are the hidden stories of human people, of suffering that we're not hearing?
Thinking about the way you sort of introduced your question here, I believe that the movement of people on the scale that is taking place in the world today is irreversible. We have, according to the United Nations, over 200 million people who are living outside the countries where they were born. In other words, who have become migrants. That is an enormous number of people. I think that even if we were able to transform the world and lived in a world in which there was social justice and there weren't these deep, deep, deep divisions and inequality in terms of the standard of living from countries like the Philippines and Mexico and countries like the U.S. and Canada, I think that people would still move, partly because we have the ability to move around the planet now that was in a way that's much easier than it was for people 100 or 200 years ago. Plus, we are related to each other across borders. We have families, some of whose members live in one country and some of whose members live in another country. And in a way, those are all good things. And we need to be able to look at a future in which the movement of people is seen as something that is positive, that is something that unites us as human beings across this planet. But, as you say, this rosy picture is not the way the migration actually exists in the world today. Most migration in the world today is forced migration. In other words, people are being uprooted and they're leaving the towns that they live in because they have no alternative if they want to survive. We negotiated, the U.S. and Canada, negotiated an unequal treaty with Mexico called the North American Free Trade Agreement. As a result of that agreement, huge U.S. and Canadian grain companies, Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill, and so forth, they dumped corn on the Mexican market, basically in order to take over the Mexican market and make money. As the result of that, for people living in Huixtlahuaca or Hualapan de Leon or the other small towns in Oaxaca who have been growing corn, actually they were the people who centuries ago, millennia ago, domesticated the cultivation of corn. The same people who began the cultivation of corn can no longer make a living growing corn because the cost of growing it is greater than the price that they could get for it in the marketplace because of this corn dump. As a result of that, those people then have to do something in order to live. And that something is basically to leave the towns where their families have been living for many, many, many generations and look for work. So people go to Mexico City, or they go to the border between the U.S. and Mexico and work in maquiladora. So they cross the border and they become farm workers in the San Joaquin Valley in California, or they become farm workers up in the agricultural areas near Vancouver. This is the story of migration, not as something that is intended to unite people across the world, but something that is forced on people in order for them to survive.
Why is it that this continues to be? I mean, there's enough information now for people to see what is happening, and yet it is only through our participation that this can continue, right?
Well, it's also only through our activity and participation that this can change. You know, we have a system that, as you know, the Occupy movement has been telling us, works in favor of the 1% and against the interests of the 99%. But the 1% in our world have an enormous amount of political power. In fact, you could say that they basically run the corporations, the government institutions of our society, and they do it in a way that makes profit for them. This is a profit-making system. This is capitalism. So if we don't like the results of that, and I think that for most people, we don't. Not only don't we like the inequality, we don't like losing our homes in foreclosures, we don't like the unemployment, we don't like the forced migration, we have to do something to change it. So that requires, you know, political activity and participation, whether it's, you know, sitting in a tent in Wall Street or in Toronto or even in Tijuana, where they had a one of the first tent encampments, or whether it is other forms of participation, whether it's getting organized into labor unions or participating in civil rights demonstrations. That's what it takes to get social justice and change our world, I think.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because unions are, in my opinion, the last safeguard against, you know, neoliberalism. It seems to me that everywhere you look, there's a concerted attack by governments to dismantle and, you know, kind of erode any gains that have been made by the labor movement in the last, you know, two, three decades. So can you talk a little bit about the kinds of struggles that people engage to unionize their environment from your experience in the meatpacking plants, or, you know, the migrant workers who people dismiss, and yet they're finding ways to organize? So if my opinion is, if they can do it, you know, why are not the people taking similar steps to unionize and organize themselves?
Well, that's a really good question. In California, where I live, most of the union organizing activity that's taken place in the last 20 years has involved immigrant workers, in other words, workers who were born somewhere else who have come here to work. And in many cases, they have been union organizing efforts where those workers were the big, big majority of the people. So one of the big examples of that would be, you know, farm workers organizing in California. California has somewhat better conditions, although they're declining because of the attacks and the weakness of the union. But, you know, they are nevertheless better than they have been for workers in many other states, and that's because of the fact that, you know, there was an organizing effort among farm workers that started in 1964, 1965, or actually even before that. But we've also have organizing efforts that have been going on among workers in hospitals, among workers in meatpacking plants, and among workers in many other different kinds of jobs. part of the reason for the high level of participation among immigrants there? Well, I think there are two reasons for it. One of them is that these are generally people who need unions. In other words, their conditions are among the worst and their wages are among the lowest. But also, people are very often coming to the United States and to California from countries where they have already had a lot of experience in terms of organizing unions or in social struggle generally. And so people are using that experience in order to help get themselves organized here. Even the idea, for instance, has become so popular since of Occupy Wall Street, of living in tent encampments on the street as a form of protest. This is a very old form of protest in Mexico or in the Philippines or in Central America, the idea that workers will go and set up a tent encampment in the Zocalo in Mexico City. We just actually saw a long two-year effort by workers in the electrical generation plants in Central Mexico, the most left-wing radical union in Mexico, to try to defend itself against the attacks by the government. And one of the main efforts that people used to do that was by setting up a hunger strike and what they called a plantón, or a tent encampment, in the main square in Mexico City, the Zocalo, where people lived for months and months on end. So in some ways, I think people have brought those tactics here to the United States, and we're seeing them used now by unions as they are looking for more effective ways of countering the fact that, you know, we really have very few legal rights as workers to organize unions here, at least in this country. And so these tactics have become very important to us. I think that the participation of immigrant workers is something that has helped other workers to organize unions, not only because they've added their numerical strength to the labor movement, but also because they brought kind of a fresh sort of thinking about how to get organized, and also what unions should be like once people do organize them. In other words, that we don't want unions that are just sort of insurance programs, but unions that have a sort of vibrant internal life with, you know, a lot of interest in culture and education, that are run democratically, where, you know, workers themselves have rights in those unions and, you know, elect their own officers and negotiate their own contracts. So I think that all of those things are ways in which migration is helping our labor movement to survive here.
Well, the labor movement is one way where workers can unite their voices across borders and, you know, transgress those imaginary lines that are drawn in the sand that divide us. There's also been a concerted effort on the part of the U.S. government to create division by, you know, the establishment of the war on drugs has primarily the effect of legitimizing the militarization of the streets and the criminalization of poor people and persecution of poor people. Can you talk about the impact that this has had, not just on organizing, but just in everyday life, and the impact that this has had on people?
Well, it's had an enormous impact just in terms of the war on drugs itself. We've had an explosion in the prison population in the United States, and particularly in California, here where I live again. You know, we now have many, many, many prisons across the landscape of the state here, and the prison population has increased many, many times. And overwhelmingly, the people who are in those prisons are, first of all, African American young people, especially young men, but generally people of color. Generally are, you know, the population of those prisons. So the war on drugs has been the pretext for this enormous expansion of the prison industrial complex and the privatization of the prison system as well, too, so that you have corporations like GEO Corporation, or Corrections Corporation of America. GEO used to be called Wackenhut, and before it was Wackenhut, it was called the Pinkertons, which anybody who knows anything about labor history will recognize that name, because they were sort of the gun thugs of the 1920s used to break strikes by workers. And here they are, you know, running private prisons. But also, it's not just the war on drugs and the private prisons. We have a private detention system for immigrants. Last year, 356,000 people were kept in detention centers because of their immigration status for at least some period of time here in the United States. And the many of these detention centers are run by private corporations. So we're seeing a criminalization of many different aspects of life here in the United States, and the people who are paying the price of it by becoming inmates in prison or becoming detainees in detention centers are, you know, African American people, Latinos, immigrants, Asian American people, poor people, people of color, women overwhelmingly, and young people, especially young people. So this is criminalizing a whole new generation of people here. You know, and this is kind of the application of this sort of neoliberal model of running society, which, you know, the U.S. has been essentially imposing on third world countries, now coming home to roost and being imposed here within the borders of the United States itself.
When we think about the urgent themes of our time, you know, the scarcity of resources, water, food, shelter, you know, things that we are essential for survival, and yet we are being told that wars are being fought in our names to protect our safety, to protect nothing. Nothing provides more safety than, you know, having access to the essentials to life, food, shelter, and water. Can you talk about how this globalization has served to concentrate the wealth, to amplify, I would say, the impact of these policies of violence on the poor?
Well, I think that despite the enormous growth in the number of human beings living on this planet, which is, you know, it is a challenge to the future of humanity and the future of our environment generally, I think the fact is still that we produce enough food to be for everybody on our planet to be able to eat decently. We produce enough material goods, enough wealth for all the people on this planet to lead a decent life. The problem that we are facing, I don't think, is really scarcity, and I'm not trying to diminish the environmental problems that are caused by the kind of unsustainable development that we've had for the last two centuries, but I'm simply trying to say that the main problem that we have still is the unequal distribution of those resources. And in some ways, I think that the 1% or the people who have power in this world justify that unequal distribution by kind of waving the banner of scarcity and saying to people, like as is said to people here in the United States, that we have to kind of guard ourselves against the hordes of people from the rest of the world who want what we have by trying to keep them from coming here as migrants, or trying to ensure that we have access to those resources, like the oil, for instance, on the terms that are favorable to us. So here in the United States, where we consume a quarter of the world's petroleum, we are kind of mobilized into support of wars that are fought in the interest of that control, and scarcity gets kind of used as the whip to force us into the support of it. And I'm thinking especially about the war in Iraq, which I think most people in this country recognize pretty clearly was a war being fought for the control of oil. So the problem that we have as a people is, I think, that we have a very unjust social system, both in this country and in the world in general, which is basically founded on inequality and the unequal distribution of those resources. It's very difficult for us to plan, for instance, for a sustainable economy on a world basis if our ability to plan is undermined constantly by the fact that the control of those resources is in the hands of people who essentially are using it for the purpose of making money, of selling it at a profit. So how do we make a decision about how to use the remaining petroleum that exists in this world in a way that's going to be able to kind of raise the standards of living and find other sources of energy, when in fact, you know, that petroleum is in the hands of, you know, these enormous corporations whose interest essentially is in controlling it and selling it to people at a profit and then sending us all off to war in order to keep that control. Again, I think that we aren't going to be able to solve the problems of the distribution of water, of food, of energy, unless we are able to establish a social system or a world in which the distribution of those resources is a fair one, in which everybody gets to benefit by using the resources that are available to all of us.
That's beautiful. How can people access your book?
Well, they can go up to my website, and there's a picture of the book on the website, and if you click on it, it will take you to a page where you can order it. And my website, the address of the website, is like my name, dbacon, D-B-A-C-O-N, .igc.org.
That's wonderful. Thank you. The book is an amazing resource. But more than that, I think it's an inspiring resource because we learned that hope is created through active participation, through our actions and the things that we take on. If we were to change anything today to make our society more equitable, what would you say are to be the first three things? I mean, we're starting the new year. Let's set up some goals.
Well, I think that we need, first of all, we need to fight for the rights of the migrant people who are living in the U.S. and Canada, that we have to do something about stopping the criminalization, and that passing here in the United States, the passing of these terrible, you know, state laws that are essentially demonizing immigrant people, but we need, you know, to fight back in the other direction towards the expansion of rights. That's the first thing, I think, is the expansion of the rights of migrant people. Then I think that we all ought to get out in the street and protest about the polarization, you know, the economic polarization. We need to, you know, get rid of this situation in which 1% of the people have, you know, almost all the resources and 99% have very little. So that's the second thing. And the third thing, I think, is we all need to care for each other a lot more.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Sylvia. Take care.
Take care. That was David Bacon, the author of Illegal People, How Globalization Displaces and Criminalizes People. For more information, you can go to his website, David Bacon, so that's dbacon.igc.org.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.